Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, coming to you today from an increasingly warm season in Vancouver as summer approaches, and we look forward to some heat finally. I have the opportunity today to generate some heat, I suppose, by speaking with a couple of colleagues from the UK. John Barber and Sophie Park are the voices you'll hear momentarily. John is an academic clinical fellow and GP trainee, and Sophie is director of medical education for community and primary care, and also a GP, both affiliated with the University College London. And I've asked them to chat with me today because they have a paper coming out in the August 2019 issue of Medical Education entitled Facilitators and Barriers to Teaching Undergraduate Medical Students in General Practice. Given that you're both in general practice, it seems natural that this would be a topic of interest to both of you. And so, Sophie, maybe I can just ask you to begin by telling us a little bit about how this project came to be.
Sure. Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. Yeah, so this paper came out of a conversation that myself, Hugh, and Bob had some time ago during the Society of Academic Primary Care meetings that we have with the Educational Research Group. And I suppose politically within the UK, recruitment of GPs has become a real challenge for many medical schools for a number of reasons to do with finance and competing with postgraduate training and various things. But we wanted to really explore afresh the topic in a scholarly way. And so we began in quite an open way. Hugh initially got a little bit of funding to support the project. And then initially we had quite kind of a broad idea of how we do it, and then brought in the idea of communities of practice as the project developed, really, as it seemed a really relevant way to look at this. And it's given us a really fresh pair of eyes to think about the topic, and it's produced some new knowledge, which has been really nice. And we've been able to integrate a lot of the findings already in our recruitment practice. That's been great.
Oh, that's wonderful, and I'd love to hear more about how that implementation has taken place. But just before we get there, John, you bring a fairly important perspective to this in terms of being in trainee mode still and living this life of interacting with individuals who are encouraging others towards GP practice. Can you tell us a little bit about what got you interested?
Thanks, Kevin, and also thank you from me for this opportunity to speak about the paper. I was really lucky. In the UK, we've got a scheme that gives clinical trainees an opportunity to get involved in research and sort of basically gives them funding for a year. And I was really lucky to get the opportunity to do one in general practice. And speaking to various people in the department, Sophie put forward this project. And it seemed like a really exciting opportunity as someone who hadn't done a huge amount of research before to really get stuck in. And education is something I feel really passionately about and find really interesting and enjoyable. And it was a great opportunity to then sort of develop a research understanding of general practice. And that's sort of how it started, really.
And to either of you, really, what are the motivators from your perspective in terms of why we need to be so deliberate about better understanding the facilitators and barriers to teaching in general practice?
I suppose we had a lot of assumptions as members of a medical school about what was going on, but a bit like in clinical practice where we're trying to involve users and stakeholders a lot more in research, we thought, hang on a minute, we really need to go to the tutors themselves and find out more about this. And through the conversations we were having, there were some quite varied experiences that people were bringing from different medical schools. So one of the crucial and, I guess, exciting bits of this project was that we were able to work across four different medical schools, which is, you know, it's still quite unusual in medical education research in the UK in terms of bringing together lots of different perspectives rather than doing research just in one institution. And that provided some really useful cognitive dissonance across the analysis and data.
I think kind of broadening that, as Sophie kind of alluded to, there's a big problem in workforce recruitment into general practice in this country. And there's research out there that says that the better the time that students spend in primary care, the more likely they are to choose that as a career. So, and increasingly, without tutors, what hope do we have of giving students the opportunities they need to be able to choose general practice in the future? And that's not a problem just in the UK either. So I think politically it's a sensitive and really important topic, which definitely motivates both of us to conduct this research.
I'm very interested in learning more about the dissonance that you described across the different sites. Can one or both of you speak to that in a way that also indicates the reasoning underlying the particular sites that were chosen? Were these four that were expected to be different in the regards that you saw them to be different?
So we did purposely sample different medical schools for different kind of characteristics, if you like, that they brought. But for example, Bob's school in Kiel had the wonderful position of being very well resourced in terms of their GP tutor population. And that's a reflection of a lot of hard work that I think Bob has put in over the years into recruiting, retaining and supporting those staff. But at the time of us doing this study, at least, they were in a good position in terms of their tutor recruitment. We have at UCL have been struggling to recruit enough, partly because we're trying to expand the course, but partly because for a number of reasons in London to do with space and increasing locum rates and various challenges, we're really having to work very hard to keep the number of tutors enough to provide the placements that the students love and provide fantastic feedback for. But so we're trying to select both newer and older medical schools, but also medical schools that had these different positions in terms of their current recruitment. What's the word?
Success rate?
Yes, exactly.
In terms of recruitment?
Exactly, yeah. In terms of how many tutors they have available to teach and whether they're struggling to recruit them.
Right, okay. And I see within your methods that you deliberately tried to select individuals to interview who were new to teaching, some who were established and some who had recently stopped. So
really wanted to capture that population of people who had recently stopped. And of course, that was the hardest population to access, but it felt so important to the topic of this project that we needed to get that data.
Right. And in interviewing those three, you both already alluded to communities of practice as a theory that was very useful to you. I suspect most people have encountered that who would be listening to this podcast at some point, but can you tell us a little bit about how you were thinking of it at the time?
We contemplated two or three different theories as a way of going about this project, but this one just felt so relevant that this is the one we plumped for. And of course, there are many ways of using communities of practice theory in doing research, but we tried to be quite explicit about the way in which we'd focused our use of it in this analysis. And that was really important for us because we were analysing across four different institutions. So we had to be quite clear about what our analytical categories were and how we were going to use those and characterise those. So we had participation, we had reification, and then we talked about brokers and boundary objects as our analytical categories. And we got each site to start looking for those categories within their data and both discuss those within the institution and the people who were involved in the project within the institution, but then across. And then we looked at each other's data to ensure that we were actually thinking about those categories in the same ways, even if we were developing different perspectives about those from the different institutions.
Well, and one of the intriguing things for me that I enjoyed reading about in this paper was the intersection of a variety of communities that the people are feeling part of and experiencing those things. You describe membership in a community of clinical practice or the community practice of the medical school or of the community of teachers. How do people resolve any sort of tensions with respect to which community was their priority at any given moment?
I mean, I think it would be fair to say that obviously all of our GP teachers are a part of a clinical community, and for others would be to a greater or a lesser extent a member of a teaching community and of a medical school community. And I think the main challenge that we found and sort of highlighted was that in the context of a primary care system that is stretched, it's so easy and understandable that clinicians would feel a need to focus on the clinical aspects of their role to the exclusion of fostering a community for their teachers or of being a part of the medical schools. And that's beholden onto the medical schools as well, who are obviously trying their best to recruit, that it's up to them to try and foster that community for their teachers. And the people we spoke to felt, to a greater or lesser extent, a part of that medical school community or a part of a community of teachers, but all were a part of a clinical community.
And I suppose what I was really intrigued by, and I think probably surprised, was how fragile that membership of the teaching community of practice and the medical school community of practice was. I hadn't expected to be so fragile, and that really came out in our data, the strength of this clinical community of practice and the importance of core membership in the clinical community of practice in determining whether teaching would be legitimate, would actually take place. For example, we had this interesting distinction between GPs who were partners, who seemed very core within their clinical community, and then we had a whole range of kind of salaried through to locum GPs who were much more peripheral in terms of their clinical community membership. And that really seemed to shape how and if the teaching took place. So, for example, the partnership could shape the ethos of the practice and whether teaching was a normal or normalized part of clinical practice. But then the partners were saying, oh, well, actually, our clinical priority is patient service, and we probably haven't got time to deliver that teaching ourselves. Whereas the locum salaried GPs were saying, yeah, this is great. We actually can earn a bit of a salary from doing this. You know, we've got autonomy to teach. We have time to do this. But then their peripheral membership was kind of limiting that in terms of they might not have the trust of the practice or the trust of the patients, and even the support of admin and partners within the practice to make it happen. And so if they were taking on that entire organisational burden themselves and doing it all independently, that almost made the teaching activity even more peripheral than it would have been otherwise. So it sort of had this ironic sort of separation as to whether it was a normal bread and butter part of clinical delivery or not.
It's interesting as well, the kind of talking about the fragility of this relationship between the different communities of practice. And I think that's probably where we frame this paper as being relevant to all kind of community education environments, because I guess where you have that geographical separation of institutions where teaching and care are delivered and where you're trying to actually organise the teaching, then in all those circumstances, be it general practice or many others, that separation creates a very natural barrier which you have to try even harder to overcome to really engage with your students and with your teachers, which was a really interesting reflection.
And again, related to the broker role that the administrative and teaching lead staff had within the university, again seemed so fragile in that it was literally a personal relationship between them and the tutor that made all the difference and made tutors say, yeah, you know, I feel I have this sense of membership because I've got that direct relationship with a particular member of staff in the medical school.
Yeah, well, and as you talk through those facilitators and barriers and the fragility of the situation, many of them sound like things that aren't easily, if at all, malleable or modifiable. And so I'm pleased to hear that you started making changes that take advantage of these results. And given that many of the barriers in particular that you've raised are often played as trump cards, leading people to just throw their hands up and say, there's nothing we can do. What are you doing with these findings that you think is yielding some benefit?
So I suppose one of the first things we did was to acknowledge the boundary objects that came out of this study and try to celebrate a bit more and actually reify the GP tutor effort. So we've introduced more GP tutor awards that we've started presenting at our conferences, and that speed of feedback that GP tutors say that they valued and the detailed nature of that we've really listened to in terms of trying to make that process a lot slicker so that the tutors can get that relationship consolidated more and stick it into their appraisal files and actually you make it part of their professional tick box success.
I think the recruitment was a really interesting reflection as well, wasn't it, Sophia? In the sense that so many of the teachers that we spoke to had approached medical schools themselves, having not really been approached by the schools and wanted to teach. And it made us think, gosh, well, how many people are there out there who actually don't realise that this is a really great opportunity for them and something that they could do right now? And that led us to think much more broadly about how we can recruit teachers. And so you're probably better placed to come in on how we're doing that.
Yeah, I mean, that has meant that we've really tried to find alternative and creative ways of recruiting tutors. But again, those same challenges have come up for tutors in actually trying to operationalize it. This study has really helped me to support tutors unpick that in helping them to try and normalize teaching within their practice so they don't feel it's a personal experience. But actually, yes, these are reasons that we've recognised across the country, and these are perhaps ways that you might help to normalise teaching in your practice, or to go to the administrative and partner staff to try and get their support and avoid that kind of isolation of the teaching, but rather to bring it into the central bread and butter part of practice.
Well, and given your statements about the fragility of these things, I'll maybe ask one final question around the presumption that one needs to be constantly thinking about and aware of the risk of these things falling apart. And I assume it's going to require some ongoing continual investment to try to make sure that the teaching communities are supported and nurtured. And so do you have any final advice in terms of how we might encourage people to stay engaged with trying to continue to create the facilitators and overcome the barriers?
So, no, go on, what were you going to say? Sorry, John.
Well, I was just going to say, I think it's interesting looking at what you've done, Sophie, is to kind of try and put into systems the things that are likely to be helpful, and in how we've sought to kind of construct the teams and make sure that we have people who are outward facing, who all of our teachers can get in touch with. And that we're building in regular ways of encouraging and rewarding and celebrating success. But doing that in a way that is sustainable and systematized, I think, is really important.
And I suppose one really important form of verification that we haven't wanted to ignore is money. And yeah, I mean, nationally, it is acknowledged as a real challenge in that we have different tariffs for primary care teaching that we do for hospital teaching. And this research again has provided another insight into that. Yes, there are all these other things that we can do to try and maintain the relationship and support that as much as possible. But one important form of verification is money, and it's still a real challenge that we need government support to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, inevitable challenge, and that's certainly not going to go away anytime soon for most of us. But I want to wrap up just by drawing listeners' attention to this paper, in part because I think it provides a wonderful case study that's evident even in the way that you're talking about it, of how one can productively go from seeing a very practical problem that they're living with to some data collection and thinking broadly about the value that a conceptual framing might provide in terms of helping you think differently about the issues, and using that as a way of advancing the practical relevance of the work and moving towards addressing that particular challenge that you were seeing in the real world. So it feels like a very nice positioning within both basic science as well as applied knowledge building. So congratulations to both of you and to your co-investigators. I'm sure I speak for many when I say that we look forward to seeing what else comes from your group.
Thank you very much.
So just as one final reminder for those who are interested in tracking down the paper for the additional useful details that are there that we weren't able to cover, it's titled Facilitators and Barriers to Teaching Undergraduate Medical Students in General Practice. You'll find it in the August 2019 issue of Medical Education, and you'll recognize the names of John Barber and Sophie Park as the two who you've just been listening to. Thanks again to both of you for making the time.
Thanks, Kevin.
Pleasure.